from the late 70s all the way until in the mid late 80s, mm-hmm. you're on the road, working musician, I imagine, beginning to step out as a songwriting frontman, or always, what was the general configuration that you spent those formative years?
I was really living out of my car, mm-hmm. more than anything else. I went back to Austin. Austin just kept calling me back. I mean, it's truly is my natural habitat. That is my, that's where I feel most home. And so it just kept calling me back, and I'd keep going back, but then I'd get pulled out to other, I was full of wanderlust.
Yeah.
And it brought me to, I'd gone to Tulsa because Leon had Shelter Records going up in Tulsa, and yes. I had this idea that I could be a session guitar player up there, and then perhaps get a record deal and do things out of Tulsa. Well, about the time I got to Tulsa, he was wrapping things back up and going back to L.A. because he was married to Mary at the time, and at Tulsa that was frowned upon, as you can imagine. And so while in Tulsa, I had met some guys from Muscle Shoals. And I had always loved the music that was coming out of Muscle Shoals. That was like Mecca to me, and still is. So we made a record down there on kind of the... we would go in the studio at when it was dark. So from midnight to 8 in the morning, hmm. and we would record all night. Mm-hmm. And we somehow or another put... together enough to make a record, which never came out. But I took some of those mixes and went back to Texas and then pressed my own records on 45s and mailed them out in little, you know, with my 8x10. And I still have one if you like. No, I'm not, don't, cool. probably don't have it. But it was a way to get work. And so Texas was home from then on. Austin playing, opening for Delbert countless times, Willie countless times.
Yeah.
I was like the local opener in Austin, you know, when somebody needed me at the Austin Opera House, or Tim O'Connor was real good about putting me on show. So I got to play for a lot of people pretty quickly. And
interesting, I was going to ask this question. I wrote this down. Because Delbert's on the same bill, in fact, you guys are playing one after
back
the other,
back, yeah.
At the festival. Just briefly, how do you think your story and Delbert's sort of basic goals and posture as musicians compare and contrast? You guys strike me just as peas in a pod,
yeah.
But maybe there's some subtler differences about the way you pursued what you did, and, you know, more in summary than, of course, the big story. But like, how do you see the differences?
I don't think there's anybody closer to the source that from whence I came,
yeah,
than Delbert McClinton.
Seems like it to
me. He just got there quicker than I did. Delbert's a couple years older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in fact, made a bet when we were still both in Texas. He said, you know what you ought to do is you ought to go meet my friend Gary Nicholson up in Nashville, Tennessee, and get you a job up there. Mm. Writing for Tree Music, they pay you a salary, and you can, you know, all this. He painted this beautiful picture for me, and I thought, well, I'll do it if you'll do it. And so we made a bet on it, and we moved here within about 2 months of each other.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
So everything, there was I played on his records, Sending Me Angels and Monkey Around, he played on a bunch of my records, and we would... Anytime I was hosting a TV show, it was a natural because we were kind of the misfits. You know, mm-hmm. we don't know what these guys are, but they're the same. So let's put them on together. And, you know, it's interesting. Haggard, I'm looking at this photograph of that Marty Stewart took of Haggard on your wall here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was crazy. I mean, he was just crazy about that kind of music. Merle was more, he was more like an uncle to me,
mm-hmm.
really, than a friend. I was just in awe of Merle Haggard, his writing, his playing,
that's
his
the band. Right way to be.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
unbelievable. And then to have been enveloped into a friendship situation with him, and then even closer than that, I would say, he was very much a proponent of what Delbert was doing, what I was doing. He got it. It wasn't what he did necessarily, but it was part of the puzzle.
Right, right. The R&B side of country music, mm-hmm. roots music as it came kind of from the Deep South, but mm-hmm. that extra level of kind of refinement and musicianship that Muscle Shoals yes. kind of conceived in those remote studios in that little country pocket. It's cool.
If there ever yeah. was, there are missing links in this. And yeah. and as I'm looking at all your books over here, and I'm thinking, yep, he knows about Emmett Miller. You got to know about Emmett Miller. Yeah. There are people who were missing links along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Where did country, and because anybody with any sense at all can figure out that country and blues are just first cousins mm-hmm. as close as they can possibly get mm-hmm. in their true original form. Now, if you take R&B today or you take country music today and you pull the top records off the charts and you play them side by side, they won't say anything a lot because they've both gotten away from what they really are. But if you go back to what, where they, from a seedling, yeah. they are of the same tree. Just different branches. Mm-hmm. As Muddy Waters said, the blues had a baby and they called it rock and roll. And, you know, so is rock and roll. It's all the same thing. And Emmett Miller, a minstrel man from Georgia, was from Macon, Georgia. He went to New York and he recorded all that stuff at Jack Teagarden and Pops, Satchmo, or Louis Armstrong. For those of you who don't know all Satches, he was really important in my music, too.
Yeah.
He was a missing link. Delbert was a missing link.
Yep.
And he never cared. I was so confused when I got to this town. I was living over in East Nashville. When I got to town, it was the hardest move I ever made in my life. It was December of 87 when I came here. And I had a friend, have a friend, who had a couple. It was a couple that had a home over behind the East Nashville High School. What used to be East Nashville High School, right yeah. where Galton Road turns into Main.
Yep.
And they had a mother-in-law apartment, and I moved into this place and lived there for 3 years. That's where I lived, not far from Orman's house, actually, mm-hmm. when he lived over there. And it was, I remember I was still running. My knees would allow me to do that. And I remember running, going, how am I supposed to fit into this thing up here? You know, I don't know how. I knew this was the place I needed to be. I was recounting the story. We were in Key West last week for the Key West Songwriters thing, and my cousin Robert O'Keen was there. And I was recounting the story, and Robert was in the room, and he substantiated the story of the night that he was renting a place on a Park Place, and Lyle was staying with him, and they got on the phone. One was on one phone back when you still did that, and the other guy was in the other room, and they had decided Leroy needs to come to Nashville because I was getting cuts.
Oh.
I didn't know how I was getting them, but I was getting cuts, but you know, I wasn't making any money at it. And they convinced me. They said, if you'll move up here, he said, there are banks up here that will lend you money to buy a house. There are banks up here that will lend you money to buy a car.
Uh-huh.
Things that were really hard to do in Austin, Texas, or Peoria, Illinois, or Sacramento, California. Sure. It just didn't exist anywhere else. But this place knew it had a. They knew about pipeline money, which is something you don't hear about much anymore. But back then, pipeline money was everything because it was expected that if this guy had this, this, and this, then we can expect this.